it so long. And no recession can stop my confession or silence my song. These are the oceans, and this is my dream. I am a slumdog, I am a wrestler.
Hello and welcome to Xavier's School for Gifted Podcasts. We're proud to present you Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. Do you like my Patrick Stewart impression? I think that was pretty good.
Spot on. I thought he was in the room with me.
My name is not Patrick Stewart. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is the best there is at what he does.
Mike DiCrescia.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I'm excited for my future of being the best at what I do.
Yes, but what you do isn't very nice.
Whoa. I'm sorry, world.
I'm guessing that it's a reference that went over your head.
But that's fine. It whooshed, but it's fine.
It's a very famous Wolverine quote from the comics. I'm the best there is at what I do, but what I do isn't very nice.
And then
he probably says bub at the end.
Probably, most likely.
But if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and then after that, we will move on to our featured review. This week, it is the newest film from director James Mangold, the 10th overall film in the X-Men franchise, and supposedly the final one featuring Hugh Jackman in his iconic role as Wolverine, Logan. Are you excited to talk about Logan, Mike?
Yeah, I think we're going to have a lot to say about this movie.
I think so, too. I saw it a couple days ago, and I've just been thinking about it, like, nonstop since then. I know you just saw it yesterday, right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so a lot to unpack with Logan, and we're pretty excited to talk about that. But first, we got to get into some film news.
Hi! It's time for...
It's time for some film news, and since we just did an episode last week, there's not as much news as we usually have to pour through, which is kind of nice, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. But there is a couple of stories I did want to talk about, and this one is really interesting to me and also kind of distressing, and I'll say why in a second. But Travis Knight, who's the CEO of Leica Animation, who just made his feature directorial debut last year with Kubo and the Two Strings, one of my favorite movies of the year, he has been hired to direct a Transformers spinoff movie focusing on Bumblebee.
Which is a sentence we never needed. that's not a thing that has to happen.
That is a sentence that I never needed, and on the one hand... this might be the only way to get me interested in Transformers.
You know, that's actually a really good point.
This is a franchise that has been in the stranglehold of Michael Bay for 10 years now. 5 movies across 10 years.
Jesus.
It started in 2007, the first movie. It's 2017 now, and we're still making Michael Bay Transformers movies. Like, we got to be done.
Yeah.
We got to be away from this. We got to be over this at some point. And this looks like the way that if they're making more Transformers movies, and it seems like they're not going to stop anytime soon, like hiring somebody like Travis Knight, that piques my interest a little bit. Sure. So on the one hand, it's one of the few things that can get me interested in a Transformers movie. On the other, what does this mean for Leica Animation Studios, Mike?
This is confusing. If there's two things that don't ever go together, it's Michael Bay clusterfuck movies and, like, Leica Animation, like, that style of studio.
The careful precision of Leica Animation.
Like, I don't know what these, like, what this, like, if we get a claymation stop motion, like, heartfelt story about Bumblebee's life and his family, like, maybe?
I would be really into that, I think, actually.
His journey from being... a little Volkswagen Beetle, and growing up into being I don't even remember what he is, a Camaro, I think.
Some kind of car that they could sell advertising to.
Yeah, like to being this giant alien fighting robot, like that'd be interesting. Like
sure.
his transformative journey.
His transformative journey.
Hey. Of course, he'll have a weird animal companion, but this time it's a human because he's a car. It writes itself, Mike.
It does. Okay. I see where you're going with that. But I'm more distressed because, you know, Leica Animation has been making some of the best movies of the past few years. Like, that's their movies are incredible. I loved Kubo. I love Coraline. I love Paranorman. I like the Box Trolls, too. These movies are really, really good. But these movies aren't, like, big box office hits, you know?
Yeah.
And so my fear is that Travis Knight signing on to direct a Transformers movie is a sign that maybe Leica is not doing so well.
Yeah.
You know?
They need some money to fund their Leica.
Maybe. Or else Leica might shut its doors entirely. Like, what if that happens, Mike?
I know. Tragic. I hope not.
I would be distressed. I would be overwhelmed if that were the case.
Yeah.
And I hope it's not. I hope it's not the case, because Leica, I think, is the best animation studio working today. And Kubo and the Two Strings, man. Have you seen that yet?
No, I haven't gotten around to seeing it yet.
You got to watch it, like, immediately. It's so good. So yeah, hopefully Leica's sticking around. And, you know, Travis Knight seems like a very talented guy. I loved Kubo, and that's his only feature directorial credit. But he's been in charge of Leica since the beginning. But he's actually the son of the CEO of Nike.
What?
Yeah. And so I guess that's how Leica was funded, because he has, like, all that Nike money to throw
around. Yeah,
so
maybe, to do literally whatever he wants.
So maybe Leica's not in trouble, and I'm, like, reading way too much into this. But at the same time, I just really hope Leica's okay, you know?
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
The real story here is hopefully Leica's all right. Who cares about the Transformers movie?
Yeah, that's the thing. If I have to sacrifice Leica for a Transformers movie, I'm going to be very upset.
The movie gods are not just, Mike.
Yeah, exactly. We live in the Snyderverse, Mike, as we seem to say every week at this point.
We're going to need to retitle the podcast.
I don't think we should do that. I think we're going to get a lot of angry people who are, like, listening in and trying to be like, oh, this is a DC fan podcast. And then it turns out it is the exact opposite.
Yep.
But anyway, let's get off the Travis Knight news. I did want to talk about this. Joe Carnahan, director of films like The Gray and Narc, he was attached to Bad Boys 3, which is currently titled Bad Boys for Life. I got to say, if you're going to call a Bad Boys movie Bad Boys for Life, shouldn't it be the fourth one?
You would think.
You would think. But the Bad Boys movies have never been known for their intellect. And so... And so Bad Boys for Life is the third one. And Joe Carnahan was attached to be making this movie for a long time, and then recently it got delayed. It was supposed to come out this year, and now it's coming out, or the release date is in 2018 now. And now he is off the project, probably because, as we broke the news last week or 2 weeks ago, he is now attached to direct a remake of The Raid starring Frank Grillo.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if I would much rather have a Raid remake, even though, as we kind of talked about, like, The Raid, the original is so good, like, we don't really need a remake of it. But I'd rather have that than a third Bad Boys movie.
Here's the thing. I think, you know, and it's weird that we were talking about Transformers, which is a Michael Bay thing, because Bad Boys is also a Michael Bay thing. This would have been the first Bad Boys movie that Michael Bay did not direct. And I was kind of interested in seeing what that would be like, you know, seeing maybe
that's true.
If I could possibly see a good version of a Bad Boys movie. Like, that would be... That would be kind of neat. And, you know, it'd be cool to see Will Smith back in action and stuff like that, because he's had a kind of a rough run of movies over the past few years. And so if there was a good Bad Boys movie with Will Smith, like, making some star power moves, like, that would be kind of neat. But since Joe Carnahan's off the project, so goes my interest in Bad Boys for Life. It's actually kind of interesting, because Joe Carnahan has been attached to a lot of high-profile projects over the past few years and has dropped out of a lot of them, too. He was supposed to be making a remake of Death Wish, which would have starred Frank Grillo.
Right.
That never ended up happening. He was also supposed to do a movie adaptation of Daredevil back before Marvel had the rights again. It was still at Fox, I think. And he had this whole, like, storyboard, like, artwork stuff going on. He had, like, this whole reel. I think he posted his reel of whatever that movie would have been online. And it looked really cool. And Joe Carnahan's a guy who could probably pull off some really great stuff with Daredevil. And that just never came to be. And I think as soon as he dropped that project, that's when the rights went back to Marvel and the TV show into production.
Right.
So that's what happened there. But, yeah, so Death Wish, Daredevil, and now Bad Boys.
Yeah. I guess we're going to have to put our Will Smith saving hope in whatever that weird superhero Netflix movie he's got coming out.
Oh, Bright.
Bright.
Which is directed by David Ayer, the director of Suicide Squad. So we'll see what happens.
So, whoops, never mind.
Oh, David Ayer. I mean, the problem with Suicide Squad, I think, is more with the studio than with David Ayer himself. But, you know, I'm still not a big David Ayer fan in the first place. So we'll see what happens. you know,
we'll see.
It did look interesting based on the trailer that aired during the Oscars that I saw. Anyway, so get off the Joe Carnahan news. Finally, there's this one last thing I wanted to talk about. Steven Spielberg, one of my favorite directors of all time, and I think one of the best, has a lot of projects lined up in the near future. This year he's got The Kidnapping of the Garden Mortada. The year after that he's got Ready Player One. And then the year after that, Indiana Jones 5. It's coming down the pike, which was actually just recently announced, officially announced by Disney. So they've got the release date set, and Spielberg's back, Harrison Ford's back. That's all set in stone. But Steven Spielberg was just recently announced to be directing Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep in a movie called The Post, which is about the Washington Post's legal fight to publish the Pentagon Papers. So I think for the Oscars in 2020, whatever this movie comes out, I think you can just write those in at this point.
Yeah, it's just there a lock already.
Yeah, start working on your pools now, because like the only way this could be more Oscar friendly if Daniel Day-Lewis was in there somewhere. You
know? Yes.
And one of the characters might have been handicapped or something.
Right. And it's Daniel Day-Lewis's character, obviously.
I mean, he would have to be. Yeah, but that sounds really cool. I think that's an exciting prospect. You know, you know, Spielberg and Tom Hanks have worked together a few times, but they haven't – or actually, no, never mind. I was about to say they haven't worked together in a while, but they did make Bridge of Spies just 2 years ago, which is a movie that I really liked. And a movie that I feel like you came down on a little bit as
– I think a little bit, yeah. I don't think I liked it as much as you did. But it will be exciting to see another, I'm going to guess, kind of thriller, exciting movie. You know, it's along the lines of Spotlight. Those kind of investigative journalism.
Spotlight or All the President's Men, that kind of stuff.
So, I'm excited. That's an interesting genre. I like it, especially if we're going to have Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep.
Yeah. Three great people doing great things all the time.
Yeah.
All right, so that's film news for today. There really wasn't that much to discuss today, but I figured we'd throw out a couple of things there. Usually there's since we do this every 2 weeks, there's usually like some big kind of superhero story or some kind of like big blockbuster event. This time, not so much, but there was some interesting stories that I thought deserved attention, and those were those. So
don't worry, Mike. We're still going to talk about Marvel stuff for an hour.
That is true. That is true. We got a lot of Marvel stuff on the way, but before we get into all that, let's get into our discussion.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, let's get into our discussions on Film Bookcast. Now, normally, Mike, you start off with discussions, but this time I'm going to start off with discussions because one of your movies coincides with the movie that we're talking about today for our featured review.
Yeah, we're gonna pretend we know how to segue. So
exactly,
you can go first, Mike.
We're not pretending because we planned this out ahead of time.
True, you're right.
So we know how to segue. We are official segue officials.
We're segueologists.
We are official segue officials. That's the
there it is.
The That's OSOs. The anyway, I've got a couple of movies I want to talk about today, as well as a TV show. The first of them is A Cure for Wellness, which is the new movie from director Gore Verbinski. And this is a movie that follows Dane DeHaan as a young man climbing the corporate ladder who finds himself in a creepy mental hospital and begins to uncover the mystery surrounding it. I was kind of excited for this movie. I'm a big Gore Verbinski fan. You know, he's a guy who makes such visually rich movies. And I feel like almost half the probably about half the time, a lot of times they're not that good, but like he is so I think he has such a distinct vision for what he's doing. I mean, he directed The Ring, he directed the first three Pirates of the Caribbean movies, he directed Rango, he directed The Lone Ranger, and now he did A Cure for Wellness. And, you know, with all those movies, I think they're, like, some of them are legitimately great. Like, I think The Ring and Pirates of the Caribbean, the first one, and Rango are all really good. But you look at the Pirates of the Caribbean 2 and 3 and The Lone Ranger, these are movies that got a lot less critical acclaim than those other ones. But they are movies that I still really like because they have such a visual style to them. And also, like, I think there are set pieces in all of those movies that rival anything else that a studio has come out with in the past, like, 10 years or so. I mean, you know, I think of, like, Pirates of the Caribbean 3 and, like, the insane ship battle in the middle of a hurricane that is going on in that movie. Or I think about the climax of The Lone Ranger and, like, the train sequence that's going on. It's insane.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot going on. I love the the water wheel sword fight. I think it's the second. Is it the second Pirates?
I'm pretty sure that's the second one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that is an insane concept to, yeah. to make that happen. And like the pirate, I am a pretty staunch defender of Pirates of the Caribbean 2 and 3 actually, because they are a lot of fun. You know, I'm not a fan of Pirates 4, which Verbinski did not do, because that movie fell very flat and there wasn't much going on. But yep. Pirates 2 and 3, they're so fucking bonkers, and like the mythology surrounding them is so weird, and like so little of it makes sense. I
that's the best part, though.
I remember watching Pirates 3 in a very crowded theater, and there's the scene where who is it? Naomi Harris is in that movie as like the witch person. Like the,
yes,
and
yes.
And in the second movie, she's in it and she's kind of like this voodoo priestess who is like somebody who can bring back Jack Sparrow from the dead or something. And then in Pirates of the Caribbean 3, she's like some kind of goddess who turns into like this gigantic she beast. And then explodes or something. Like, and I can't even, like, this is 10 years later, I can't even fathom why that happened. You know? I don't understand it. But, you know, it's like, there's so much ballsiness and bonkersness going on with these Verbinski movies that I can't help but admire. And so I was pretty excited for A Cure for Wellness. Like I said, I love Verbinski. And this is likewise a visually rich movie. And it's also totally insane. I can't understand how a studio greenlit this movie. As I was watching it, and I had a lot of fun with it. It does suffer from a lot of these same problems that a lot of Verbinski's movies do. It is way too long, you know. And you know, you look at the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and the Lone Ranger. Even Rango is like 2 hours, which is an animated kids movie. Almost all of his movies clock in at like more than 2.5 hours. This one also clocks in at 2.5 hours. And you know, this movie takes a lot of its cues from stuff like The Shining and Shutter Island. It seemed like it was a big influence on this movie too, based on what I was watching. There's just so much insane stuff that's happening in this movie, and like it is very slow and it's very methodical. But I was pretty on board with it for most of it. I don't think it's great, but I think it is a really interesting movie that I would probably – I don't think I'll be rewatching it like I do some of Verbinski's other movies. But it is a really interesting mystery, and it kind of gives you just enough to go on as the movie goes on. And you could make the argument that it doesn't give you enough to go on for most of its runtime, because, again, it is 2.5 hours long. And it feels like it. Like, it feels like it's 2.5 hours long. But I did really enjoy it. And like there's so much insane imagery going on in this movie. That it really has to be seen to be believed. There is more eels in this movie than I've seen in my entire life.
I think I'm good. I'll pass.
Yeah, there is some gross shit happening with the eels in this movie, but it is pretty bonkers. And so A Cure for Wellness I wanted to give a shout out to, because I love Gore Verbinski. I think it's a really interesting movie. This bombed the box office, and I can't imagine why. I mean, that was sarcasm, but it is a really interesting movie that I think people should check out if they like weird cinema, in any case. And then I also wanted to talk about Warcraft, which you talked about a while ago on the show.
Yeah.
And I just watched recently. This is the video game adaptation directed by Duncan Jones. And this got terrible reviews when it came out. Which is why I didn't go see it in the theater. I would have gone to see this in the theater because I love Duncan Jones, but the terrible reviews deterred me from it. But, you know, I figured it's on Blu-ray now, and I was able to get it through Netflix. And so I was going to watch it regardless because it's Duncan Jones. You know, I love him. And I was hoping for some kind of underrated masterpiece out of Warcraft, you know?
Something that everyone just missed.
Yeah. I was hoping to watch this movie and be like, man, everybody was wrong. There is some hidden genius under the surface of Warcraft. But alas, that was not to be. Warcraft might be the worst movie I've seen in a long time. It is so bad. And you know what I think the main problem with this movie, the thing that really bothered me from the beginning, is that it never gives you a chance to get acclimated to the world that it's throwing you into. And I am all for being thrown into a world and picking things up from context. You know, like the John Wick movies do a perfect job with that. You know, you go, you watch John Wick and you kind of pick up elements in this world as the movie goes along, and like you start to understand like this world. Warcraft never introduces you to anything and just expects you to know everything that happens. It just does things, and it's a viewing experience that I would describe as overwhelming. As soon as the movie started, I was like, oh man, this, I am out of my element. I do not know what's going on. You know, there are like 100 characters in this movie, probably like 50 locations. Nothing has weight to it. I didn't know who anybody was. You know, I kind of knew who, like, Paula Patton was, because she was, like, a half-orc, half-human, and she was the only one that was like that. Then there was somebody who was, like, a wizard or something, but they didn't explain that he was a wizard. He just was a wizard.
He just had magic.
And, like, Ben Foster was in this, and, like, Ruth Negga was in this, and Dominic Cooper was in this. Like, some really talented actors were in this movie, and I had no idea who any of them were. Like, I barely recognized a lot of them, because I was just like, I don't know what this character is doing, and I don't know who was in this scene. Like, I couldn't follow it from scene to scene. I couldn't follow it from, like, line to line. I feel like characters would exchange dialogue, and I was like, wait, what are they talking about? And you know, there's a couple of the battle sequences of this movie are like mildly fun. You know, like I'm not made of stone. I enjoy seeing an orc smash somebody with a hammer. You know, that's that can be fun, but it loses its luster pretty quickly, and it's not enough to recommend. You know, this movie really fails in every level. It's kind of astounding.
Yeah, it feels like a 2-hour first act of another movie because it doesn't do. I remember like it doesn't resolve anything. It just introduces the plot. Okay, here's some orcs, and then like we're gonna, it's a thing, and then it ends, and like that issue's not finished. Like it's not, like it doesn't, and it's not even in a satisfying way that like, oh man, it's a cliffhanger, I need to know what happens. It just is kind of like a lull in the action, and then we just roll credits. Yeah. Like it felt really weird.
Exactly. And I'm not somebody who has played any of the World of Warcraft games. I have like only a vague knowledge of World of Warcraft to begin with. But this movie, I mean, I feel like the experience of watching this movie is probably similar to watching a cutscene in World of Warcraft. You know, it's like visually, that's what it felt like to me. And you know, this movie looks super expensive. And I'm sure it was. And the movie did pretty well. Like it bombed here, but it did pretty well overseas. I don't know if it did well enough to make back its budget or not, but it broke like records in China and stuff like that. So I was really hoping for something out of this man. Like I was, because I love Duncan Jones. You know, he did Moon and he did Source Code, and like those are movies that I really like. And you know, he sunk like 5 years of his life into Warcraft. Like he's been attached to this since Source Code came out. So I was hoping for something really great out of Warcraft, and it did not deliver. But you know, I'm not giving up on Duncan Jones. I feel like he kind of got sucked into the studio machine and was like forced to serve several different masters. Probably Blizzard Entertainment was probably the biggest thing there. You know, he is coming out with a new movie on Netflix this year, Mute. So pretty excited to see where that goes. I mean, have you seen any of the photos or anything from the set of Mute? It looks like Blade Runner.
Really?
So it looks pretty cool, and it looks like it's much more in his wheelhouse than something I want to see from him. So I'm not counting out Duncan Jones just yet, you know.
I think he'll be okay.
I think he'll be fine. And finally, I did want to mention this one last thing. Since we are talking about Logan today, I figured what better time to talk about the new TV series on FX set in the X-Men universe, Legion, which is developed by Noah Hawley of Fargo. Guys, I am in love with Legion. This is like the boldest and most insane adaptation of any superhero property that I have ever seen. And I've been telling you to watch it for a few weeks, and you haven't done that yet, right, Mike?
I haven't gotten around to it yet, but I think I'm going to have to. You've been singing so much praise.
Yeah, you absolutely have to. I mean, you love Fargo, so I think you should love Legion. Like, it's from the same guy, and it's I think there's a similar sensibility, but it's much more bizarre than Fargo is. And that right there, I feel like, is a bold statement, but
that's pretty hard to do.
But the aesthetic of the show is somewhere between like Stanley Kubrick, Wes Anderson, and Terry Gilliam. And these are guys who have very different styles, but this show somehow meshes all of them together at once. Dan Stevens is the lead in this show, and he is outstanding. And he was in The Guest, and he was in Downton Abbey. I think he's quietly become like one of my favorite actors. He's like really, really strong. I know he's playing Beauty and the Beast, the new remake that's coming out as well. And the cast is filled with great performances, especially from Aubrey Plaza, who's in this show as well. So I thought I'd mention this since we're also discussing Logan today. And between the two properties, it is a damn good time to be an X-Men fan, man. Like, Legion and Logan are happening at the same time. Like, and these are two of the most unique and interesting adaptations of superheroes I've seen in a long time. So pretty stoked for the future of the X-Men at this point. At this point, a year ago, I was not as stoked.
Yeah, you know. I was going to say, it feels like hardcore X-Men fans have been waiting for this moment, and I think they might have finally gotten it.
Yeah,
Where they're excited for the movie/TV versions of their characters.
Yeah, less than a year ago, we were complaining about X-Men Apocalypse, you know?
Right, yeah.
And now we've got Logan and we've got Legion, like two of these really highly critically acclaimed properties of X-Men characters, and they are really fucking good. Yeah. Spoilers for our Logan review. But anyway, yeah, so that's Legion. I wanted to mention that since we are talking about Logan today. But Mike, you have a couple of things you wanted to mention today as well, right?
Yes, I have two movies today. The first one is I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. This is the directorial debut from Macon Blair. It's available on Netflix, I believe. It's a Netflix original, I think?
Yes, well, I mean, it was...
Kind of, sorta?
Well, it was picked up by Netflix, so it is. I think it is considered a Netflix original. Like, if you watch the movie, which I did a couple days ago, if you watch the movie, it says, like, a Netflix film at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's actually in the opening. It doesn't just have, like, the boom Netflix thing.
Right.
It actually says, like, a Netflix film or whatever. But they actually – I mean, they produced the movie independently, and then it was picked up at Sundance by Netflix.
That was – yeah. I knew there was some story about Sundance. Couldn't remember exactly.
Yes.
But Macon Blair is a longtime collaborator with Jeremy Saulnier, who's made Blue Ruin and Green Room, which I think we were both big fans of.
Sure.
This is his first movie on his own, and it is a incredibly weird – awkward and hopelessly dark comedy. It's like, it might be one of the darkest comedies that I've seen in a really long time.
Okay.
Blue Ruin and Green Room both follow, and I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, follow a similar, you know, basic story of a average person gets forced into a situation, they get by consequences out of their control, and they decide to go for it and rise to the occasion. Whereas Green Room and Blue Ruin play that for tragedy and serious drama, this movie manages to make it hilarious.
Yes.
And it's just interesting to see the same type of story beats. And I don't mean to say that there are the same story each time.
Right.
But the same type of the same story beats played from a different angle. And just whereas someone's arm getting horrifically mangled in Green Room. In this is Monty Python style blood pouring out of someone's neck.
Yes.
I just thought it's really hilarious. Elijah Wood and Melanie Lynskey are my new – we need more buddy cop movies from them forever.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. I mean, Melanie Lynskey I've been a fan of for a long time. She's great on, like, Togetherness and stuff like that. And Elijah Wood I love too. I've been a big fan of his for a long time. He is phenomenal in this movie.
I kind of love his recent career of just doing weird shit.
Yeah.
Like, just doing whatever he wants.
Pretty much since Lord of the Rings came out, I feel like he's just had cachet to do whatever the fuck he wants.
Yeah, like what? He doesn't need dollars. Like, just do whatever.
He spent 4 years starring on an FX sitcom featuring a talking dog, you know?
Like... Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah, it's pretty beautiful. And I am very excited to see the future of Macon Blair. And Jeremy Saulnier, I think, is on my list now. I talked about Green Room, of directors that I want to keep a very close eye on. And I think Macon Blair is on that list now.
Yeah, absolutely. And Macon Blair, I mean, he was also the star of Blue Ruin. I don't know if you mentioned
that.
Right. He was the star of Blue Ruin, and he was the supporting actor in Green Room.
Yeah, and he does have a cameo in this as well, which in like one of my favorite – in the first 5 minutes, I think. Like, absolutely hilarious.
Yes.
Just spoils a book. Like, just one of those guys.
Yes.
The best thing ever.
That was really good. But what is insane about this movie, won at Sundance. It won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance, which is like the highest dramatic honor you can get at Sundance. That's an honor that's gone to Whiplash, got that. Me and Earl and the Dying Girl got that. The Birth of a Nation won that last year. This could have gotten like a huge theatrical release. It could have been maybe a qualifying for Oscars and stuff like that. But Netflix picked it up and within 6 weeks put it out on the streaming service, which is insane.
That's amazing.
So that is incredible for I feel like we talked about this so much. The tide is somewhat turning. Even last week's podcast, we were talking about this year in Netflix original movies, and there are so much stuff coming down the pipe. With stuff from Duncan Jones and Bong Joon-ho and Martin Scorsese's The Irishman will be coming out on Netflix at some point. So it's very exciting for movie fans. So we'll see what happens. I will be interested to see the future of this movie. Like, do you think this is going to result in more people seeing I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore than they would have otherwise?
I guess. I feel like, we just as we talked about, it seems like literally every human has Netflix.
Exactly. I do also feel like Netflix hasn't really advertised this movie that much. And I can't understand why that is, because they must have paid, you know, a decent amount of money to get it from Sundance.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and if it won the Grand Jury Prize, like, how could it not be their biggest touted movie right now?
Yeah.
Because it just came out. Why is it not? But, and this is the thing that we've kind of talked about. I don't know if we've talked about it, but, you know, the Netflix algorithm, we each see our own Netflix homepage. No one sees the same thing. So who knows where it's buried for everybody, even though it should be the top for everybody. I don't know. It's weird.
That's true. They should have, like, some place where they want to spotlight, like, the new – I mean, they have, like, a new releases tab and, like, recently added tab and stuff like that. But, like,
Civil War has been there for 3 months. Like,
come on. Yeah, there should be some kind of rotating list of, like, the highlights of Netflix or whatever. Like, there should be some kind of, like – like, I mean, I've said this before, the best interface for any of this kind of stuff is HBO Go, because everything's alphabetical. You can just, you can just, like, scroll through and see things, and, like, it's much easier to search. Whereas Netflix, it's just kind of, like, thrown on there. And it's the same with Amazon Prime. Like, everything's just kind of thrown on there, and you're kind of left to fend for yourself. Like, if you don't know that something is on Netflix, it's very difficult to find something.
Yeah. You know? So that's our Netflix rant.
Yeah.
The second thing I want to discuss is Netflix. No.
now that we're done talking about Netflix, let's talk about Netflix.
actually, I have a point to make about the Snyderverse. No. the second movie I want to discuss is James Mangold's The Wolverine.
Okay, yeah. So we're talking about Logan today, and you had not seen The Wolverine.
Yes. Yeah, the previously touted best Wolverine movie.
well, out of the two that there were.
Were there only two? Yeah, I guess you're right. There was only two.
If you want to get serious about it, almost every X-Men movie is a Wolverine.
It's about
movie.
Logan.
It's about Wolverine, Logan, in some way. Yeah. but at that point, like, the solo Wolverine movies were just the Wolverine and X-Men Origins Wolverine, which was terrible.
That's a good point. I guess I forgot about that.
But The Wolverine, yeah. So you had not seen The Wolverine. I feel like The Wolverine, it came out in 2013. Got some buzz when it came out. It was pretty well received, I think. I really like The Wolverine. Yeah. I think the movie's really good. But I feel like it kind of got forgotten because Days of Future Past came out a year later. And it erased the events of The Wolverine.
Right. It also, I feel like The Wolverine also, or at least for me personally, really was hampered by how bad X-Men Origins was, because I was like, I don't care. It's going to be the same. Like, it's another bad Wolverine, but, like, I don't want it. which is unfair on my part. I shouldn't have done that.
Fair, yeah. yeah, but so what did you think of The Wolverine, Mike? What was your overall takeaway there?
I actually really liked it. I watched the extended, I don't remember what it's called. They have some stupid name for it. Unleashed, whatever. It's the R-rated cut.
The Unleashed cut. Yeah, I have actually not seen that one. I've only seen the theatrical PG-13 cut. But I know the R-rated cut is closer to something like Logan, or at least in terms of violence.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in tone, but in terms of violence, definitely.
Yeah, and there's a couple. There's specifically one scene that I was like, oh, that's the R-rated. I got it. Okay. because otherwise, it's still kind of the, you know, Wolverine plunges his 6 razor sharp knives into somebody's chest and they fall bloodlessly to the floor. it's fun. It's big. It's silly. There's a long fight on the top of a bullet train. That was like one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen.
That scene is fucking incredible. I love that action scene.
It's so good. And it's fun. It's just, it does kind of fall apart in its third act a little bit. There's this big scene where the samurai, what are they called? The sentinels. He's like a samurai sentinel.
It's like a big robot samurai. Yeah. I do remember.
Yeah. That. Yeah. And it's fun. That was cool. Just especially considering the sentinels in Days of Future Past. Like, sure. it was kind of a weird or interesting tie-in or continuity thing to see how that progressed. And it does have some weird body horror thing, which kind of Logan always sort of has as a character, because literally he, like, what happened to him?
Yes, yeah, that's true.
They made his skeleton metal. So there's the scene at the end where they cut the claws off and they're, like, drilling into his bones.
Oh, yeah.
But it ends in a very, very, like, it literally ends on an interesting note where now he's back to bone claws, which goes away at the end.
Yeah, they never explain how he got the metal claws again.
Right. Yeah, so that was a thing I wrote down while I was watching it. I couldn't remember. I haven't seen Days of Future Past in a while. And I was like, is by the beginning of that movie, does he have metal claws again? I couldn't.
He does.
Yep. Yep. He does. Classic. Classic X-Men movies.
Yes. Yeah, the continuity of these movies is all fucked up. nothing makes sense. And I think Logan actually makes that aspect of the series worse, but it's okay because Logan's so good.
Okay. We don't want to jump into Logan stuff now, I guess. That's kind of it's a fun, interesting take, I think, putting Wolverine in Japan away from all of the other X-Men is really fun. The supporting cast, I can't remember the character's name. Oh no.
It's been a few years since I've seen it, but the samurai girl that is like also following Logan around.
Who's trying to present him with the samurai sword.
Yes.
That character is a lot of fun. The like ninja stuff that's going on is really interesting, and it's always kind of fun. You know, the Wolverine is this eternal soldier kind of thing. So to throw him into samurai soldier, like samurai culture, and like that era of warfare and stuff is a lot of fun. So that's my take on the Wolverine, I think.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the Wolverine in a little while, but I really liked it when it came out, and it was really cool. Did you stick around for the after credits scene when you watched it?
I did, yeah. I did watch the after credits scene, which was fun. Like,
it's,
I guess
I think it's a really good scene, but it also, like, in retrospect, makes no sense.
None. It is kind of interesting. Well, I'll save that. Actually, I'll save that for spoilers.
Okay, but what I remember struck me about the after credits scene, in the after credits scene of Wolverine, Xavier and Magneto show up at the airport where Wolverine is, and like recruit him to go be in Days of Future Past. Basically, like we got a problem, and that's happening. But what's crazy about that after credit scene is that, you know, at that point in the X-Men franchise, Xavier was dead and Magneto had lost his powers. That's where we had left. That's where we had left them off at X-Men 3. You know, that's
right.
And then. In the after credit scene, it was like, oh man, Xavier's alive, Magneto has his powers again, I can't wait to find out how that happens, and we never got an explanation
isn't at the very end of X-Men 3, doesn't like they transfer Professor X's consciousness to his brother's body or some stupid shit?
The after credit scene of X-Men 3
tell me, Mike, educate us,
is that it shows a Moira McTaggart, although it's a different Moira than Rose Byrne's character in the prequels. It's supposed to be Moira, even though she's basically the same age as Rose Byrne in its present day, whatever. And she's like taking care of some kind of patient or something. And you hear a voice woke up. By the way, we had never seen Moira at any point in any of these movies before this post-credit scene. This person wakes up and he says, Moira? And she looks back like, Xavier? And that was it. So, and nobody really knew what that meant. And like Brett Ratner had to do like on his commentary for the movie, like on the DVD, he explained that whole scene and was like, well, what that means, like that guy is actually Xavier's twin brother. And Xavier has taken up over his consciousness because the guy was brain dead or something. And it's like, how are we supposed to get that from what you're talking about?
From these 20 seconds.
And so supposedly that guy was Xavier's twin brother. But at the same time, like, that guy didn't really look like Patrick Stewart or anything. He didn't look like Xavier. So it's not Xavier's twin brother that shows up in that scene. It's Patrick Stewart.
And I do remember it being super confusing. I mean, I don't remember that part of it. Magneto says to Wolverine that, you know, we need help. Something that can wipe out our entire kind's existence is brewing, which is the Sentinels, I think.
Yeah.
But that happened in the 70s? Wolverine takes place?
Because Days of Future Past happens, there's the future in Days of Future Past where the Sentinels are attacking and stuff.
Right.
So I think that's what he's talking about. But yeah, no, you're right, because that stuff happened in the 70s. And also, like, Days of Future Past, like, the future part of that takes place, like, 10 years after the Wolverine.
The Wolverine, So
you're
timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly, pretty much.
Timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly is basically the thesis of the X-Men movies at this point.
Yeah.
But anyway, enough ragging on the continuity of the X-Men movies, because ultimately that doesn't matter.
Because it doesn't matter at all.
Because that's kind of something that I admire about the X-Men movies almost, is that they just give zero crap about the continuity between movies and just like, all right, just make a movie. We'll figure out where it fits in the continuity later.
Yeah. Although I think even now, we'll talk about that more, I guess.
Yeah. So should we move on, Michael?
At this point.
Yeah. I guess we should probably do it. Let's
now that Captain Segway has struck.
Now that Captain Segway has struck again, let's get into our feature review of Logan.
We got ourselves an X-Men fan. Maybe a quarter of it happened. And not like this. In the real world, people die.
Logan.
I don't want to talk about it.
Logan.
Just stop.
Be careful. I need the girl.
What girl?
Go get her. No.
All right, let's get into our featured review of Logan, the new film directed by James Mangold. It stars Hugh Jackman, Patrick Stewart, Daphne Keene, Richard E. Grant, Boyd Holbrook, and Stephen Merchant, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Logan, this is actually a very good plot synopsis. I'm very proud of IMDb. For this one. In the near future, a weary Logan cares for an ailing Professor X in a hideout on the Mexican border, but Logan's attempts to hide from the world and his legacy are upended when a young mutant arrives being pursued by dark forces.
Ooh,
intrigue. So, Mike, let's get some backstory on Logan. I mean, the Wolverine was director James Mangold. Logan's also director James Mangold. And Hugh Jackman has been saying for years that he was very close to the end of his run as Wolverine. Right. Which began all the way back in X-Men in the year 2000. Like that
before it even started.
Well, no, I'm not saying he said he was done in the year 2000. I'm saying that's when the run started. That's when he first started doing Wolverine. And Jackman's Wolverine is a huge part of why we have so many superhero movies today. Like that, it's such an iconic performance, and the X-Men was such a huge hit. And it almost didn't happen that way. Hugh Jackman was actually a last-minute replacement for the part. I don't know if you know that.
Wow.
Originally cast was Doug Ray Scott, who was the bad guy in Mission Impossible 2. He was cast in the role of Wolverine, and he had to drop out due to scheduling conflicts with Mission Impossible 2. So Hugh Jackman ended up getting the role. Imagine the alternate universe where we are celebrating the triumphant end of the run of Wolverine with Doug Ray Scott in the lead role. But man, that guy must feel like a real jackass.
Yeah, but at least he was in Mission Impossible 2, I guess.
Exactly. The worst Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
But Hugh Jackman had said that The Wolverine might be his last movie as Wolverine. And then he had said that Days of Future Past might be his last movie as Wolverine. But Logan really, truly appears to be his final round holding up the adamantium claws. You know, yeah. It just has this air of finality to it. And we'll talk about a lot of stuff in spoilers, obviously. But it really feels like the final Wolverine movie, and all the advertising has been leading you to believe this was the last run of Wolverine. And so it reunites Jackman with James Mangold, who seems to have made a very conscious effort to do something incredibly different with this movie. And Logan is really unlike any other X-Men movie out there, I think, or any other superhero movie for that matter. Like it is, it seems like it's in a league of its own almost.
Yeah, definitely. I would absolutely agree. It's the most unique, at least in the modern era of superhero movies, the post-Marvelization of superhero movies.
Yeah, because that's the thing. With the Marvel Cinematic Universe, like I love a lot of those movies, but they all feel like they're from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like, they all kind of have the same kind of tone and the same kind of feeling going on. Like visually, they're all pretty similar and all that kind of stuff. And the X-Men movies, are generally speaking like big superhero epics. And the DC movies are all the Snyderverse stuff. I would say the closest analog to Logan is probably The Dark Knight, which exists in its current form because Christopher Nolan was given total creative control. And its influences are much more in line with his film influences than with comic book stuff. That's a movie that is very much in love with the movie Heat by Michael Mann. And I think Logan kind of works the same way. And the Wolverine kind of took its cues from samurai films, too, as well.
Yeah.
Logan has a heavy Western vibe going on from James Mangold. James Mangold was also the director of 3:10 to Yuma, the 2007 remake.
Oh, shit. I did not know that.
Yeah. So I think that
makes a lot of sense.
It's all coming back around.
Yeah.
But there is a heavy vibe of Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven going on in this movie, with the reluctant protagonist, an icon in his time but way past his expiration date, on one final mission out of necessity rather than by choice.
But enough about whatever movie, because there's a lot.
But enough about every movie this one is taking cues from. It's not just Unforgiven. Shane plays a surprisingly major role in this movie, and it also seems pretty inspired by Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men in the way it depicts the world that Logan exists in. But the world of Logan to me, it kind of exists on the fringes. You know, it's just to be hinted at. This is a movie that is so deeply and intensely focused on its title character that all else kind of falls by the wayside. This is like the quietest superhero movie I've seen ever, probably. Like,
yeah.
The most introspective blockbuster I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, it's pretty beautiful. I do very much love and appreciate the fact of, you know, it takes place in the future. I think they give the year 2029 or something like that.
Yes.
Of how just barely, like you said, the world and everything around it is on the fringes. The car looks a little weird. Like we're shown some stuff that's like just tiny bit futuristic, and I kind of loved that. Where that, like you said, it's just about these characters and the world is there, but it's not. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, like the world matters. It definitely like informs what's going on.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But it really isn't about that. It's about, you know, Logan's journey and what he's going through. And you know, it's a really interesting. So Mike, I mean, you came out of Logan yesterday. What was your immediate reaction coming out of that movie?
Just a deep exhale, mostly. just wow. I'm not sure I loved it. I think I did. I did really like it.
Yeah.
And it has had a pretty profound impact on me, and just superhero movies I think are going to be changed by this movie.
I can see it.
And it does a lot of really beautiful, bold things that I appreciate. It is incredibly emotional for, you know, what we would expect going in, or, you know, if we didn't know what it was just going into this superhero movie. I don't know. Yeah, that's kind of like, it just kind of blew me away in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean,
what about you, Mike? What was your reaction?
You know, my immediate reaction coming out of it, and I saw it a few days ago, was that I really, really liked it, but, you know, I wasn't like blown away. And then like just the more I thought about it, like I was just so entranced by the world and so kind of hooked by all the stuff that this movie was doing, because it works on so many thematic levels, and yet there's also just so much incredible action sequences and so many cool character moments, and it works on a lot of thematic levels that I think most superhero movies don't even aim for.
Right.
And so I thought that was really cool. It felt like this is like it was looking at the DC universe and being like, you know what, we're going to do this the right way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It did feel like a big middle finger to a lot of those movies.
Yeah. And I feel like it's almost not even fair to compare Logan to the other X-Men movies, because it is so much better than all of them that it's a little sad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm
but I think it's interesting to see, you know, a lot of things that the complaints, especially like, you know, compared to X-Men Apocalypse, which is the worst of all, it's the worst of the worst tendencies of superhero movies.
Sure.
We have 27 characters. None of them get explained at all. There's a big beam in the sky at the end.
Yeah.
Like, who gives a shit? It's people in front of a green screen half the time. Like, yeah. It's all of the worst things about superhero movies. And then jump to Logan, and it is a serious character drama that just happens to have superheroes in it and to be about this fantastical shit. And it's a pretty amazing comparison to see what can be done with these characters and this world when that's not the point of it.
Yeah, no, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And yeah, what's one big difference about this movie compared to the other X-Men movies? This one is rated R.
Right.
And it's the first one featuring Jackman's Wolverine to not be PG-13. You know, I think Deadpool went for the R rating last year, and Fox saw a lot of success with that. And so I think it's kind of what led them to be like, okay, we'll do Logan as an R rating.
Yeah, definitely.
And that can be misconstrued. Like, that can be something that, like, I feel like the lesson to take away from this isn't that, you know, this is good because it's rated R. But I do think it's good because it allowed the filmmaker to really explore this character in a really interesting way. The violence in this movie is much more visceral, and it feels more in line with what Wolverine should probably be. And the content of this movie is just a lot more mature and different from the other X-Men movies. It's also not kind of going for the faux edginess that Deadpool aims for. And it's a lot better for it. Deadpool is a movie that I liked, but like I wasn't like blown, like I wasn't floored by. And I know you really like Deadpool, and a lot of people really like Deadpool. But this feels like just a much more complete story than Deadpool offers.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Deadpool kind of aims for that audience of like people that were like 15-year-olds, like maybe their older brother brought them to see this R-rated movie. You know,
yes,
like
that's exactly what it is.
That audience, absolutely, like, and that's fine. And it feels like X-Men or Logan aims for the audience of the people that were 15 in 2000 when the first X-Men came out.
Yeah.
Like it aims for that mature audience and doesn't shy away from, the reality, like I had said before, he's got six razor sharp knives, like, and he, like, what that would do to a body, like, yeah. And it doesn't shy away from that reality, and it deals with some heavy shit.
Yeah, yeah.
to put it lightly,
the movie is dark. You know, it is a dark, dark film. But unlike the darkness of something like Batman vs Superman, this darkness has some kind of meaning attached to it. You know,
yeah.
it feels meaningful, and it's in service of something that kind of looks like hope. You know, I think ultimately this is a movie about hope in the world of darkness. So even though the world around the characters is dark, the journey takes several horrifying steps along the way. But we are right there with Logan, Xavier, and Laura. And the movie makes us want to see them succeed, and I think it really succeeds on that front. And I think performance-wise, I mean, Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart are the best they've ever been as these characters in this movie.
Absolutely, yeah. This is I can't think of the right words now. This is one of those movies also that just, like, when you talk about it and think about it, like, emotions happen.
Sure. Yeah, I was writing down these notes for as I was preparing the podcast yesterday, and I was, like, almost brought to tears by certain things.
But Hugh Jackman, Patrick Stewart, and Daphne Keane, like, what, where,
oh,
who,
what,
oh my God.
What an incredible find with Daphne.
Yeah, between her and Millie Bobby Brown, the age of the 12-year-old mute female protagonist is upon us, I think.
Yeah, it's working out.
Yeah.
But yeah, especially Patrick Stewart, I think, is doing some phenomenal work in this movie too. But really, I think part of it is that they're really giving it their all, but all these actors. But also, I mean, this, like, the material they're given is so much better than they're usually given with these characters, you know?
Yeah, they get to do some real character shit.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
And Stephen Merchant also is phenomenal.
Yeah, Stephen Merchant under layers of makeup as Caliban, who apparently Caliban was also in X-Men Apocalypse. I do not remember.
He
that.
Was.
You do?
Yeah. I do remember that, yeah.
Really? Okay. I had to look it up, like, what he was doing in that movie. I guess he was, like, Psylocke's bodyguard or something, or...
Yeah, well, he's kind of, if I remember correctly, he's kind of like this, like, black market mutant, like, guy who runs this place where mutants hang out.
That's when Apocalypse, like, comes in and is like, hey, be my horseman or whatever. And
he's like, I need people.
And he gives her a bathing suit, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much.
But yeah, so I don't think he was played by Stephen Merchant in that movie, though. It was somebody else.
No, it's somebody else.
Okay, yeah. So Stephen Merchant plays Caliban in this movie, and he really makes an impression. I think he's great in this movie, too.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. Also, Boyd Holbrook is an incredible villain in this movie as Donald Pierce, the blonde one. I think he's so much fun. I think he really sinks his teeth into this, like, pulpy dialogue that he's given, and it's really great. Richard E. Grant as Xander Rice, I think, makes less of an impression. He's the other villain of this movie. And in truth, I barely registered him as a character until very, very close to the end of the movie. I was like, oh, yeah, that guy.
Until he becomes Dr. Exposition at the very end.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is fine.
It's fine. It's a very small thing. But it almost seems inconsequential when there's so much thematic weight to the proceedings here, but the action sequences in this movie are incredible, man. Like, they're so good. And it's not just the added violence. I mean, like, that's part of it. But, like, but I think there's so much creativity on display, and they're exciting in a way that was missing from, say, X-Men Apocalypse, you know?
Right.
I don't mean to keep ragging on X-Men Apocalypse, but, you know.
But it's the worst one.
It's not the worst one. Origins is the worst
one. Okay, that's fair.
Origins is bad. Origins is real, real bad. Apocalypse is mediocre. That's the thing. I feel like for all the X-Men movies, I'm somebody who likes the franchise in a general sense.
In a general sort of way?
I do. I do enjoy the X-Men movies. I really enjoy them. Origins is the only one I would call flat out, outright bad. And Apocalypse, I would say, is mediocre. And then from there, I would say they're all, like, okay to good. You know,
right.
I would say the only ones that come close to great, or that I would say are good, or are legitimate great, are The Wolverine and X-Men First Class. And Logan outclasses them entirely, I think. The Wolverine is probably the closest to this, obviously, because it's James Mangold, it's Hugh Jackman, solo Wolverine movie. Like, it feels the closest, totally speaking. But even then, like, Logan just, I think, outclasses it in almost every way.
Just a thought that I listened to the Slash Filmcast, and Jeff Cannata expressed this thought, and I happened to agree with it after seeing the film, where the added violence, it adds weight and is worth it, you know, like, for this R rating. Jeff Cannata mentions that it does the thing, it does the added violence within 30 seconds of the movie starting, so that when it happens again and again and again and again, it kind of loses its punch, if that makes sense, by the end.
I don't know about that. I feel like, I mean, we'll talk about a lot of that stuff in spoilers, but I feel like there was enough going on at the end. Like, there was a lot of catharsis going on towards the end of the movie.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think, at least the way I took it, took it to mean that the added violence, I guess, does add weight to, you know, Wolverine as a character, that that has been his life for however, I don't even know how old Wolverine is.
Several hundred years.
Several hundreds of years.
I remember in Origins, I think it was like in the 16 or 1700s when he was a little kid. So,
right.
It's a few hundred years.
Yeah. I do remember that was one of the one cool thing Origins did is that montage of him dying in every war.
100%. That is like the only good thing. The first 10 minutes of Origins are actually dope. Like they are, they are a lot of fun. Cause there's that montage. And then there's like that whole scene where the Weapon X team, including Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool, is like infiltrating this base or something. And like Ryan Reynolds like slices a bullet in half with his sword.
Right. And
it's a lot of fun. And then the rest of the movie is garbage.
It's terrible. But that, you know, the added weight of hundreds of years of him killing and having that violence as part of him, it works. It's interesting. But I felt like the shock value that this movie was the R-rated. We get to see the R-rated Wolverine violence and that it just happens in the first 30 seconds and then we see it again and again and again.
I don't necessarily think it's going for shock value, though. Like, I feel like...
That might not be the right word.
Like, I feel like the R-rating and the ultra-violence and stuff like that, again, it is a violent movie, but it's a different kind of violence than, say, like, Deadpool, which I think is going for shock value a lot of the time. You know, it feels like it's going for a more, like, broken-down and beaten Wolverine. Like, there's violence for sure, and towards the end it gets especially violent, but... At the same time, like he's not moving as well as he used to, and so he can't even slash throats in the way that he used to do. You know, there's like one detail happens throughout the movie where like one of his claws doesn't come out all the way, and I thought that was a really interesting touch that like you know these two come out and then the one on like between two knuckles is like comes out like halfway and he has to like pull it out and like cut his hand while he's doing it. You know, it's I feel like so. It's not so much for shock value for this violent scenes as it is just like to show the realism of this kind of moment. I did want to say though that the R rating, like the very first word of this movie is the F word.
For a good, I think, 5 minutes or so, the only word Wolverine says is fuck.
That's the thing. And that bugged me more than like that lost its luster more than the violence for me, I feel like.
Yeah.
Because that was like I get it, and I feel like the swearing in this movie is generally pretty well done. Like it informs the dialogue of this movie in a way. Like they're in bad situations, and like it's interesting to hear Xavier like spout out an F word and stuff like that. Like that's good stuff. But like the first like six sentences in this movie all contain like the F word, and it almost feels like oh we're rated R now, we can do this, and it's like it just felt like a little much.
It did definitely. I definitely felt like that. I feel like it goes away. It feels like it happened. They front loaded a lot of that. I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, we can do this. Yeah, boop. I'm making finger guns for people who can't see, which is everyone except for Mike.
I enjoyed them though.
Thanks, Mike. But then after that, they kind of were like, "All right, we got it out of our system. We got 20 years of fucks to say, and now we can keep going."
Yeah, exactly. So so that was like one small thing. But I did want to also mention that this movie. Kind of gives like a meta nod at the whole series' continuity, like its own wonky continuity, by introducing the fact that the X-Men are written down as comics. Like there's X-Men comics that are shown throughout the movie, and Wolverine's kind of like pawing through them, and he says maybe a quarter of it happened, and not like this. And I took that as like, oh, okay, so every X-Men movie is a lie. Or like you're supposed to like make your own continuity almost like whatever it is. Like it feels like a very like meta nod at the fact that if you actually look at this series of movies like we've been doing for the last hour, nothing lines up. Like we said, there's a Caliban in Apocalypse and a Caliban in Logan, and they're two different people. You know?
Right.
And they're in two different situations, and there's no acknowledgement that that is the same Caliban or if it's just the same guy. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I think it is interesting, though, like, along those lines, it's a meta nod at comic book continuity isn't a thing. I mean, it is. It is a very serious thing for people that read comic books, but it's a, like, shit show. Like, you can make an issue 20 years in the future and just be like, that explains this, like, and it's fine. You know what I mean? Like, you can do whatever you want. And I feel like they are wholeheartedly embracing that theory in Logan with the movies.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the big things about this, I was watching this movie and it kind of introduced you to this world that's like this post-apocalyptic nightmare. They just avoided a post-apocalyptic nightmare in Days of Future Past, right? That was the whole plot of that movie, is that they're avoiding this kind of post-apocalyptic nightmare where all the mutants are killed.
Right.
And so Wolverine went back in time, stopped that apocalypse from happening, came back to the present. He met up with Xavier. Those two are the only ones who know that apocalypse was reverted. And then 30 years later, they're in a different post-apocalyptic nightmare.
I think it's an interesting thing that you keep saying they're in a post-apocalyptic nightmare, because I feel like they're not at all. They're in their own apocalypse. They go to Las Vegas and it's packed and there's casinos and there's tons of cars on the roads while they're driving, and it looks like a pretty normal world.
Okay, yeah, post-apocalyptic might be a stretch, but it feels like, you know, it's post-apocalyptic for the mutants. It's supposed to, for that's what it is. And, you know, it feels like the world around them is definitely, like, the hints at the world around them seems like they're definitely worse than when we last left the X-Men. And in a way, it mirrors our own world in scary ways. For sure.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a very significant part of this movie that takes place on the U.S.-Mexico border. And a lot of this movie is about border hopping. Really cuts close to a lot of the immigration stuff that's going on today. And it's pretty insane. And so I feel like that's I've been describing it as a post-apocalyptic nightmare. That's probably because I view the world that we're in right now as a post-apocalyptic nightmare.
But I think that speaks to this movie's credit on tone and theme, and that the characters that we're with, it's like what we talked about earlier, that the world on the fringes that is the greater world that they live in doesn't really matter to this story, because for this story, it is the end times for what's going on with these characters. And I think that's to be applauded for what they're able to pull that off.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's such a ballsy move to say, I guess we should save all that for spoilers, like exactly.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of spoilers, I think.
This world. So should we do that? Should we get into spoilers, Mike? Or do you have any last things to say?
No, we can get into spoilers, yeah.
Okay, all right, let's get into spoilers for Logan, starting right now. All right, spoilers for Logan starting right now. So what we were talking about with this apocalyptic thing for the mutants going on, there is a tragic backstory accompanying Xavier in this movie that kind of recontextualizes every other film in the series too. And it's not really explicitly stated, but it's very much implied. So they do mention early on that his mind has been classified a weapon of mass destruction by the government. And when we first see him, Logan has been kept in this windowless barn. So throughout this movie, Xavier is suffering from these seizures that, because of his mutant abilities, are causing, like, destruction. And they're, like, freezing and injuring people left and right. And it's very much implied there was some kind of Westchester incident, which resulted in the deaths of a lot of people, including the X-Men. Westchester, of course, is where Xavier's School for Gifted Mutants is located. I think the implication is that, like, hundreds of people were killed in this incident. Because of Xavier's seizure, because his mind betrayed him almost, because he got old, like that was the thing. And so mutants are a dying breed in this movie. There's very few mutants left. Like Logan and Xavier and Caliban are probably like the last few. And so Laura, who by the way is X-23, is kind of like this new breed of mutant who was kind of like bred in a lab almost, right? Like that was kind of the idea behind her. And so mutants being a dying breed in this movie, it's kind of recalling the lack of births in Children of Men. It also kind of apes the refugee crisis stuff from Children of Men too. And it's an incredibly sad notion to think that the X-Men were ended, you know, not by some all-powerful villain like Apocalypse and not by the ongoing war for mutant rights from Magneto, but instead just accidentally by the man who brought them all together as a family.
Yeah.
It's a bummer, man.
yeah. There's that scene where I think it's Dr. Xavier Rice, or whatever his name is,
Xander Rice.
Xander Rice,
whose father was part of the Weapon X program that gave Wolverine his claws, who I guess apparently was in Apocalypse, like in the scene, like Wolverine kills him in the Apocalypse scene where he goes
and stuff. That makes sense.
Apparently, that's what I read online. Because again, I barely remember Apocalypse.
So that scene where he explains he talks to Caliban and he says, like, what does he have, Alzheimer's or ALS, a degenerative brain disease in the most dangerous brain, is like, that's horrifying and tragic on the most tragic scale.
Yeah.
Like, and we see that is depicted in the film when he, the scene when X-24 attacks the farmhouse, Charles Xavier says he remembers what happened in Westchester. And Logan has spent the whole movie hiding from him, or the last, however, like year, I think they talk about at some point, hiding from him, comes back in his final moments. And it's like the most tragic thing of all
time.
Absolutely,
yeah.
It's horrifying.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is what, it kind of was what makes the film's break at its midpoint, in which Logan, Xavier, and Laura are eating at the farmhouse with the family, which they help on the side of the road. It makes it really powerful because there's this sense of dread throughout the scene where they're just eating dinner. Because I feel like just from them being there, we know this family is going to suffer. Just from their association with this trio. But it's also a place where Logan and Xavier feel like a part of something again. You know, it's a really interesting part for them. And Hugh Jackman, we should mention, plays a dual role in this movie, because in addition to Logan, he takes on the role of X-24, which is Wolverine's perfect clone. And he's essentially what the Weapon X program was designed to make him, this like merciless killing machine. And Wolverine has always kind of been that, but he's also like he's struggled with that and the humanity, the human side of him, for his entire life or since the Weapon X treatment. I will say that the scene in which they fight each other the first time at the farmhouse, there was like one shot where it was like a far shot where you just see the two of them fighting each other, and it really reminded me of the scene in Army of Darkness where it's good Ash and bad Ash fighting each other, and I was waiting for X-24 to be like, "You're the good Wolverine, and I'm the bad Wolverine. You're a good little two shoes."
But even much to that trope, and specifically talking about Westerns, Logan is in a white tank top, and X-24 is in a black tank top.
Yes, he is.
And it's perfect.
Yeah,
it's
so James Mangold was actually talking about that. An explicit thing that he did, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So that was definitely cool. And in that scene, I mean, that whole sequence was incredible, the whole farmhouse sequence. And yeah, that scene, like, you have Caliban dying in that scene. You have Patrick Stewart as Xavier dying in that scene, which is brutal, man.
It's like, also, I think, while they're at the eating dinner, the first time we see Laura smile and laugh, which makes it just all the worse, like, for everything that happens after that.
Yeah, that's very true. But the death of Xavier, I think, is such a powerful moment, not only because it is the death of an iconic character who, like, we had already seen die once in X-Men 3 and came back with no explanation, but whatever. Because in the context of this movie, it places Logan on his own journey. Like, Xavier was the one who wanted to go on the journey in the first place. He's the one that, like, insisted on it and has been insisting that the two of them need to get back to a mutant family. And now Logan has come to the point where he realizes he needs this too. Now that Xavier is gone, Logan has to come to that place himself, and that he cares for Laura after closing himself off from the world for so long. You know, his only goal at the beginning of this movie is to get a boat so that he and Xavier can live out the rest of their days in peace away from the world. And so this is like a movie where – this is a moment where he has to immerse himself back into the world to save a person that he's grown to care about over the course of this movie, which I thought was really powerful and really interesting. And I should mention Laura we mentioned Laura is X-23, who's one of your favorite comic book characters, right? Like, you're a big fan. Of X-23.
Yeah, I came back and I read the first issue of All New Wolverine that I have. Yeah.
Yeah. That first scene where she reveals her claws.
Oh, God.
Holy shit, man. And also, I had seen that in the trailers and stuff. Like, I knew it was coming, but it's still so cool. Like, it's just such a badass scene. Like, she has, she's like in the house eating like a bowl of cereal, and these guys come in, and you hear, and then you come back to the outside of the house, and you just hear the struggle going on. And she comes out with a guy's head in her arms, rolls it over to Boyd Holbrook, and then she like drops her backpack, and the claws start coming out, and then the snips happen. Yeah, Boyd Holbrook has the best reaction to that too, where he's just like, no. No.
It's great.
And then she starts just annihilating people, and then she has fucking foot claws.
Yes. That when I read the first issue of All New Wolverine, which is Laura Kinney is taking over Wolverine in the comic book continuity.
Right.
And there's that moment the first time in the comic books where she uses her foot claws, and that blew my fucking mind. It's so simple, but so beautiful at the same time.
Yeah.
And then it happens in the movie, it's fucking awesome.
It was so well executed. That whole scene was insane. I mean, that whole escape from Caliban's place and onto the Mexican border. Like, there's that whole car chase segment of that, where Logan, Laura, and Xavier are in the car, and they run through the fence, and the fence gets, like, barbed wire, and, like, a dude gets caught in the barbed wire, and they're just, like, driving around, and they barely reach the other side of an oncoming train. Like, it hits the back of their limo. Like, it is.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And it's such a well shot, and, like, well, like, just visually such an incredible scene. And I think that's really what Mangold brings to the table. Like, he brings a lot of the stuff to the table with this. Like, I feel like this feels like a very personal film for him. You know, on a lot of levels, like, for him and for Hugh Jackman. And he's bringing a lot of his outside influences into it. And, like, you see in his other filmography, like 310 to Yuma, he also did Walk the Line. And a lot of stuff like that. Like, he's just a really interesting stuff. But actually, I mean, he did Walk the Line. This movie ends with a Johnny Cash song.
Yeah,
I should.
I mean, it certainly has the same feel like that. Or, I mean, it's the Western theme. You know what all that is, what all that means, and the weight that theme brings to a story.
Yeah.
But it was that car chase scene and that whole segment reminded me. I mean, it wasn't similar to the bullet train fight of the Wolverine, but it brought me back to, like, that level of action. Even though in the Wolverine and that scene specifically, it's a much more silly comic book.
Yeah,
fight. What's like on the top of a bullet train.
I think these two movies, the Wolverine and Logan, are going to be really interesting to watch back to back, which I guess you just did. But I mean, the Wolverine to me feels like a much more, like, pure Wolverine story almost. Yes. It feels like that's, like, Wolverine at the top of his game. He's got action going on and stuff. And, like, what's interesting about both of these movies is that James Mangold seems to understand that in order to make Wolverine a really interesting character, you have to weaken him somehow, because otherwise he is invincible and it's not that interesting.
Right.
So in the Wolverine, he loses his healing factor for about, like, an hour of the movie's runtime. He gets it back at the end. And then in this movie, he is – I mean, it's not that he's lost his healing factor so much, but that he's just so old and broken down. Like, his body isn't regenerating as fast as it used to anymore, and, like, he is, you know, a lot slower these days.
Yeah. I think it is a really interesting thing they say – kind of hint at and talk about a little bit. I mean, I guess it's kind of explicit, but they say they keep mentioning something is poisoning you, something is dying inside you.
Right.
And then when Dr. Exposition happens, he says, oh, he's the one that put this poison in me. So the adamantine is leaching into him and killing him. Like, he's got blood poisoning, I assume, or something along those lines.
Right.
Which is a really interesting, his whole sense of being is literally killing him.
Yeah,
slowly.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Tragic. Yeah,
absolutely. And what I do think it is really cool about this movie, it plays with a lot of the iconic imagery and references from throughout the movie series, but it leaves them very vague. Like, you can watch this movie. You can watch this movie completely cold, like, you not knowing anything about the X-Men. I think you can pretty much get it. You know.
Yeah.
But I think it has a lot more weight if you have been watching at least a couple of the X-Men movies over the past 17 years. Like, if you watched X-Men back in 2000. And then just watch Logan in 2017. That would actually be a really interesting way to do it. Like, if you just saw those two movies.
Yeah.
What I was going to say, like, there's stuff throughout the movie that references other stuff in the X-Men movies. But, like, if you hadn't seen any of them, they're not going to take away from your enjoyment of the movie. There's stuff like you see the dog tags and the adamantium bullet from Origins. You see the samurai sword from the Wolverine is hanging on his room. There's a line in the movie where Xavier and Logan are talking about the end of the first X-Men movie, and they say the Statue of Liberty was a long time ago, which could it could be read as a reference to X-Men, or it could be read as commentary on the state of the world in the real life, maybe.
Yeah. So I did read an interesting thing, though, that means Days of Future Past didn't happen, because if Days of Future Past happened, none of that other stuff happened. So, like...
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think,
like, what?
The way Days of Future Past worked, we don't know what did and didn't happen. No, I will say it is incredibly unlikely that the Wolverine happened, because the entire reason the Wolverine happened is because, Jean Grey died, and that movie is, like, Wolverine out... on his own because he's, like, mourning the death of Jean Grey. And at the end of Days of Future Past, Jean Grey's alive again, so why would he go out and do the Wolverine?
You know? Well, I mean, I guess it just happened differently then.
I guess so.
Because he still has the sword.
Exactly. Like he says, maybe a quarter of this happened and not like this.
Yeah. But I was going to say, speaking to that experience, though, of having not seen the other X-Men movies, I saw Logan with my parents. And
oh, really?
Yeah, and I don't really know. I mean, they probably had seen the first three ones, probably because I wanted to go and I made them go with me back then. But I don't think they've seen the other ones. And they came out of it, and they both really enjoyed it, and they really liked it. They were like, but wait, who is this? And, like, what does that mean? And, you know, they had some questions just because it's, like, a general lack of knowledge about the 10 movies we've had.
Yeah, I think if you watch this movie and as long as you like know who Wolverine is and you know who Professor X is, like, you're pretty much good, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and they did love the comic book details, like the literal comic books,
yeah.
And the one of the kids at the end is holding a Wolverine X-Men figure or action figure.
Right.
Like, you know, there was a lot of details and stuff that they enjoyed. But who doesn't know who Wolverine is, right? Through cultural osmosis,
exactly,
everyone
yeah.
knows who the X-Men are or have heard of them and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, that was all I had to say about that.
Yeah. and I will say, after watching an entire film of a broken down Logan, like, I was really into it. Like, I was enjoying the movie a lot. But it is so cathartic when he takes the serum and briefly becomes Wolverine again, basically. You know,
yeah.
You know, they there's a part where they shave his beard to make it look more like his beard from the original movie,
right.
And it just looks like, I was like, there's the Wolverine I know. Like, I was so happy about that. And he becomes Wolverine again, goes into like berserker rage mode to save Laura and the other kid mutants. And even though, like, at that point, I went into this movie expecting that Wolverine would probably die at the end. Like, I just felt like that in my gut. Like, I just kind of knew it. But at that point, it's like inevitable when he takes most of the serum, because there's like even a thing on the bottle that says like, don't take all of it at once.
Yeah.
And he took most of it. And in that moment, though, when he's like just annihilating dudes and saving Laura, it's where he lives up to everything that Laura had expected and read about in the comics that she grew up with. And I think that's really cool. That's where like the legend becomes the legend, almost, like the man,
right.
Like, he, like, there's so many things in this movie where people like know who Wolverine is. Like, even Boyd Holbrook's character, when he first introduced himself, he's like, Wolverine, I'm a big fan. Like, I heard you were in town and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And so there's like this aura around him that like people are like, people talk about him like he's folklore almost.
Right. There's comic books about him. Like,
exactly. You know, when Laura meets him, I think she's initially disappointed. Like, again, she's mute. So it's, but like through body language, you can tell like she doesn't really want to be there. And like, she's angry at him, he's angry at her and all that kind of stuff. But in that moment, he like becomes the legend that she needed him to be, right before his death.
That scene, there's something that just happens when, superheroes team up, like in, Age of Ultron, where, you know, we see Thor hitting Captain America's shield and the sound wave kills all the guys in Sokovia and like all this awesome shit.
Right.
And that scene when Wolverine or Logan and Laura fight together and they're both in their berserker rage and they're like, she's jumping off his shoulders and like all this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
It felt, you know, like you just said, the legend becomes the lives up to the legend.
Yeah.
And he, oh man, it's so good.
So good. So good, man.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's the whole fight, like, boss battle number two with X-24 comes around. X-24 comes out, like Wolverine and him fight for a while. And at this point, Wolverine's, berserker rage is wearing off. The serum that he took is like, it was only good for a short time. And now he's like about to die. Like, he is like,
yeah,
like he is getting brutally beaten. But Laura is able to kill X-24 with, Wolverine's adamantium bullet, you know,
yeah.
Set that up in the first act, paid it off in the third.
Chekhov would be proud.
Yep. And, it's really like that whole scene is a statement, you know, that side of Wolverine, the violent, perfect killing machine that X-24 is, Wolverine's basically been fighting for his entire life. This berserker rage guy that was always lying underneath, with X-24's death, it feels like that's officially gone from Wolverine. And in his last moments, he knows something that's somewhat like peace, you know, and hope for the next generation. And I found that to be really interesting. And then that's of course followed up with, the funeral scene in which, the mutant kids bury Logan, Laura recites the speech from Shane, which she had watched earlier in the movie with, Patrick Stewart. And I thought that was a really interesting scene because, you know, you never get to just watch superheroes like kicking around watching movies, you know?
Yeah.
And so I thought it was really interesting that like, Xavier was so taken with Shane. Like, that's something that really left an impression on him when he saw it when he was, I guess, a young kid. And so it's really interesting that like I've stayed with him for his entire life. He's supposed to be 90 in this movie. And so it's, I thought that was really cool. And it obviously left an impression on Laura as well. And so she, gives the speech from Shane, which is about, people being like, I don't have the exact words from it right now, but, it's about people who, the toll killing takes on people and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know about you, but super trying not to get emotional right now. Just thinking about the scene, but, something along the lines of, you know, that you are, a man is what he is and can't break the mold. And, Killen is just a brand. Like, it's really what Wolverine is. And like you said, that symbolism of killing X-24 kind of proves that sentiment wrong. Like, what Shane is saying at the end of that, in that speech.
Yeah.
That, you know, you are a man is what he is, and he has to do what he's got to do, kind of thing.
Sure.
But it's that funeral scene. So then they walk away after Laura gives this little eulogy, and she stops and comes back and turns the cross into an X on his grave.
Oh,
and
man.
Like, manly tears were shed.
Yeah.
Like,
God damn,
outrageous.
Man.
So, yeah. Like, yeah, beautiful. It's beautiful.
Oh, man. Oh. It was just so good, man. Yeah, it was that was incredible. That was just. Just the lighting of that scene and like the mood that creates and like everything is just so perfect. It's man, like,
yeah.
I gotta say, like, the more we talk about it, the more I really feel like this is like one of the best superhero movies ever.
But like, for real, I think it might be.
Yeah,
like, it definitely is.
It is pretty insane how good Logan is. And you know, like, I've made fun of Fox so much, you know, over the course of the past several years of my life. Like, they all, like, just the way they've handled the X-Men franchise, like, it always seems like a joke almost. Like, the way they handled Fantastic Four, like, they totally screwed that up. But I have to give them credit for just letting James Mangold and Hugh Jackman do their thing with Logan and really allowing it to allow Hugh Jackman to ride off into the sunset doing something really special with this movie.
I do hope that the success of Logan and Deadpool, which, you know, it's a totally different type of thing, but it did kind of allow Logan to be what it is. That's it. I hope that the success of Logan allows them to realize that this may be the formula, quote unquote, to follow going forward. I'm kind of over their failed attempts at making interesting big budget, the 27 character team up X-Men movies.
Yeah.
Like, just give us small solo or duo with, I mean, I guess it kind of follows the Marvel thing then, like, you know, here's four or five solo movies and then one team up movie and then four or five solo movie. And then,
sure.
But I think this being able to exist on its own, like, tangentially related to the larger X-Men universe, but being able to do its own thing, having complete creative control, it seems at least.
Yeah.
And just doing small scale stories. I think it's, the future for X-Men, hopefully.
Yeah.
Because if they go back to doing, which I think their slate is, to go back to doing the other things, they might not work out so well.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. I do think, I guess next is Deadpool 2, probably. I think they're doing New Mutants next, too, also, which is...
But, like, I want these New Mutants, like, and that sucks that it's not going to be them.
Yeah, I mean, New Mutants, though, could be interesting. Like, I do want more character-centric stuff. I think that's... A really interesting route for these to take, but the X-Men to me are about this group and this family.
It is the team,
and so New Mutants seems like it would be a whole new team. Like, it wouldn't be any of the characters that we've seen in other movies, and so it's almost like a fresh start. You know, because like you wouldn't have to deal with Cyclops and Storm and Jean Grey and like all these characters that we've seen so many times before. It could be something new and interesting. They've also talked about a sequel, like another X-Men 4 set in the 90s. Which, you know,
a Gambit movie in theory.
Gambit starring Channing Tatum, which we'll see if that ever happens. That's gone through like two or three directors at this point. Right now, Deadpool 2 seems like Deadpool 2 and New Mutants seem like the only certainties right now. And Deadpool 2 will probably lead to an X-Force movie too at some point. What really upsets me about Logan is that they finally got it right just in time for the last one. Just for the final one. And I would have watched like five movies of Logan and Laura.
And that's the thing. Like, at the end of X-Men Apocalypse, it kind of teases the stinger at the end of that, kind of teases the X-23 connection in the main universe. If I remember correctly,
Mr. Sinister or something.
Sinister, and like, he's related to the company. Like, I remember looking it up that X-23 is related to Mr. Sinister in some comic book continuity fashion.
I remember that happening, that post-credit scene, and Bryan Singer was saying it's supposed to be related to Logan. And then as this movie's coming out, people saw the movie and were like, so how did that post-credit scene line up with Logan? And James Mangold was like, it didn't.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Don't worry about it.
Also, it's a big deal that there's no post-credit scene in this.
There is no post-credit scene. A lot of people are I mean, I stayed through the end of the credits anyway, just because, like, we were just sitting there, like, talking with my friends and stuff about the movie. And, like, I knew there was no post-credit scene about, like, into this, and I didn't expect there to be after the after this movie ended. Right. But a lot of – there were people in my theater who stayed and were, like, visibly pissed that there was no post-credit scene.
Yeah.
But it does have a pre-movie scene. I guess we should mention that. Since we might as well throw that out there. There was a Deadpool short before this movie.
Which was phenomenal.
It was very solid. I enjoyed it. You know, it's basically just one joke, but it's a joke that's done very well.
Yeah, like, it's great. There's all the little Easter eggs and stuff that I loved in it.
Yeah. Did you watch the version that went online, by any chance?
Yes, with the Stan Lee.
Yeah, I was surprised that version, like, they didn't add the Stan Lee cameo
in the theatrical.
But I enjoyed the bit, though. It was funny, and, like, you know, it has the Superman theme playing over the phone bit, and, like, I'm a sucker for the Superman theme, so, like, I was enjoying it. I was just
so sure. They also, I think if I remember correctly, Patrick Stewart has said that he would only play Professor X again if it was in Deadpool.
I think he said that, and he also said apparently he was on James Corden's show, and it happened to be a show with Dan Stevens from Legion.
Okay.
And the thing is, on Legion, I mean, they haven't explicitly said this in the show, but in the comics, Dan Stevens' character on Legion is Xavier's son. And so Dan Stevens on James Corden's show asked Patrick Stewart if he would be on Legion. And he said yes. So
who knows?
So who knows? I mean, I doubt Dan Stevens has the power to hire him for
for Legion. But then again, Patrick Stewart is on American Dad, so, like, he'd probably do it, like, just for the lulz.
Yeah, so we will see what happens. Because, I mean, he could do it, because, I mean, Deadpool and Legion both take him present day. And Logan is in 2029, so, like, he wouldn't die for a long time, and he wouldn't kill all the X-Men for a long time.
Yeah.
But that would be in the back of my mind, like, oh man, all these people are gonna die.
They're all gonna die.
Thanks to you.
I do hope that, you know, because of the way Laura or Logan happens and when it, like, the timeline and stuff, that Laura doesn't, as a character, ever come back. Or I hope she comes back, is what I'm saying. I hope we're able to see her included in other X-Men things.
Well, I think Fox is desperately seeking a way to find out how to get her into a movie at some point. I would be shocked if she doesn't show up in X-Force or something, you know, like, that would be... Like,
even if it's not Daphne Keane, who is amazing in this movie, three-quarters of the movie doesn't say a word.
Yeah, I think it has to be Daphne Keane. Like, I would be upset if it wasn't.
Yeah, I agree that I desperately hope it's her, because for three quarters of this movie, she's silent and is amazing. But just as a character, like we had mentioned, X-23 and Laura Kinney is, like, my favorite thing so far. Her and Spider-Gwen, pretty close. So I just want her in more stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, she does a phenomenal job in this movie. And yeah, she is mute for, like, two-thirds of the running time, and then when she does speak, she mostly speaks Spanish, which I thought was a really interesting touch. Like, that would make sense, because she's built, like, it was like a lab on the U.S.-Mexico border, right?
I think it was in Mexico or something,
yeah. So it would make sense, and so I thought that was a really interesting touch, and, like, just the way the kids interacted and stuff was really cool. Logan, it was so good.
Yeah.
And the more I talk about it, the more I want to see it again. I feel like
really just want to go see it again right now.
Yeah, just to experience it more. I feel like this seems like a very special kind of superhero movie that we don't get that often. And, like, I am excited for the other superhero movies coming out this year. You know, Marvel has three movies out this year.
Did you see Thor cut his hair? It's a big deal, Mike.
I did not.
But for real, though.
like Chris Hemsworth, like, hair, or like Thor?
No, like, the character Thor is short hair, though.
Really?
In Thor Ragnarok, apparently.
Yeah. I did not know that, but that is
it's on the cover of Entertainment Weekly.
Oh,
I think it came out today. hot off the presses, Mike.
Hot off the presses, as always. But yeah, so, you know, I'm excited for those movies, you know. But I feel like everyone, like this is like a genre-stopping movie. Like, everyone's going to have to stop and, like, consider what they're doing with superhero movies going forward. And Marvel has been doing a great job. I love their stuff, and, like, they can absolutely keep doing their zany kind of, like, enjoyable, like, fun movies to be watching. And, you know, DC can still do their darker, grimmer universe or whatever. And
we'll keep making fun of it.
We'll keep making fun of it. Sure. unless they start turning out good.
Unless it's good, yeah.
Which I don't trust them to do, but, you know, we'll see. But this really feels like, in the same way that, like, Unforgiven is, like, the final word on Westerns, you know, that movie was, you know, Clint East, that's the last Western Clint Eastwood ever made, and it's a movie about, like, an iconic Western hero, and it's, like, this existentialist kind of, like, thought process about what goes into the making of a Western hero and, like, the importance of that legacy and stuff, and this feels very similar to Unforgiven in that this feels like the definitive final word on what superhero movies can be, and now we have to rethink of what they are. Going forward, and so we'll see what happens. So I'm excited, you know, I'm excited for Guardians 2, and I'm excited for Spider-Man, and I'm excited for Thor, but, like, it's going to be really, really tough to beat Logan this year, I think.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, we could talk about Logan for another 5 hours, so I guess we could stop.
I guess we probably should, but, yeah, so yeah. Final thoughts, it's really good.
Amazing. bring tissues.
Yeah. So, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. And you can check out my other work at crookedscoreboard.com. Thank you so much for listening to FilmBookCast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriccio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you are emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones. Hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks, in which we are ready to go ape for Kong Skull Island. I'm pretty excited about Kong too, Mike.
Yeah, I've been hearing some good stuff about it.
Yeah, I'm hearing it's a lot of fun. You know, it's very heavily influenced by Apocalypse Now, it seems, which is a strange choice for a Kong movie. but
sure.
But I'm into it. I'm gonna rewatch. I might do it today. Actually, I have a box set that has the original King Kong, Son of Kong, and the original Mighty Joe Young. I may end up rewatching those movies sometime this week. But I am pretty stoked for Kong Skull Island. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And then you can check out our next Complete Works next week, where we're going to be talking Nicolas Cage's role in The Family Man, which the name of that movie sounds like an old person who doesn't know the name of Family Guy.
Oh my God. It does. You're right.
We're watching The Family Man with the talking dog.
Oh my God!
But I'm interested to talk about that. That is actually a Brett Ratner movie who directed X Men 3. So there's a connection there with this, because we mentioned X Men 3 a couple times today. So anyway, thank you guys so much for listening. We are out.
All right, I need some help for this one. Annie,
what?
Annie, come and give me a hand.
No,
don't take me. Just trust me. Relax.
No.
Relax. Okay, just sit there. Trust me. By the way, you look gorgeous. Why didn't you burn the tapes?
I don't know what I'm supposed to say here.
18 minutes, all erased.
I mean, it's an honor. I just would have loved a heads up.
America deserves an apology.
Franklin Jello was sitting right next to me.
Stop your lies right now and tell the truth.
Do you really want to do this, Jackman?
It's Frost. Confess to me.
Why can't you let this be? Give me my dignity.
Look what you've done to me. Why is your upper lip so sweaty?
Is it?
Yes, but I like it.
Mr. Frost, I think I love you.
Oh, Nixon. You know I love you too. Anne Hathaway. Thank you, Anne.